Good afternoon. My name is Matt Woodbury, and I'll be bringing you the Pantograph News today from the edition dated Friday, March 16th. Let's get started with a story on the first page that's titled Epiphany Farms Brings Fresh Concepts to Table. Speakeasy Korean Barbecue Planned for Bloomington. This is written by Julia Evilsizer. In a town known for its mass quantity of restaurants, Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group knows how to bring some fresh to the table. Epiphany Farms Hospitality Group, or EFHG, has opened three farm-to-fork restaurants in McLean County since 2009, with two more unique spots in the works. The kitchens are stocked with produce harvested from the company's 100 acres of farmland in Downs and Bloomington. If we can diversify our restaurant concepts, we can stay in this town and do things the community would benefit from, said Ken Miska, owner and director of operations for EFHG. The new restaurants will join Epiphany Farms Restaurant and Anju Above, both in Bloomington, and Old Bank Restaurant and Bar in Leroy. Emitting a speakeasy feel, the bakery and pickle bar will open in a few months at 513 North Main Street in downtown Bloomington. It will have a unique reservation system in which you have to engage with the company to receive the password to enter, said Biska. He said clues for the password eventually will be shared on the company's YouTube channel. The entrance to the restaurant is slightly hidden, said Miska, with space for up to 90 people. It will have a throwback feeling and energy. It will be a little bit more edgy, with a Chicago West Loop vibe, he said. The restaurant will serve Prohibition-era recipes and cocktails with a focus on locally distilled spirits. The ever-changing menu will feature charcuterie platters and fresh seafood like cedar plank trout and oysters Rockefeller. Open for dinner, the restaurant will also be available to rent as an event space. The location currently serves as the bakery for EFHG restaurants. The EFHG team also is working on transforming a space at 7 Currency Drive in Bloomington into the Twin Cities' first traditional Korean barbecue restaurant. Opening in early 2019, the large restaurant will provide a healthy, fun, and interactive dining experience, according to Miska. It will be named after my wife's grandmother and will highlight Korean recipes from her home and family heritage, said Miska. His wife, Nanam Yoon Miska of Seoul, South Korea, is co-owner and financial and administrative officer for the company. Miska said his team will take a trip to South Korea this summer to research the dining experience. Diners at the Korean restaurant will be presented with an assortment of vegetables, pickles, sauces, and rice, straight from the farm, said Miska. You then order your choice of high-quality protein, and the servers will fire up the grill at your table and start cooking the food for you. The servers guide you through the experience, he said. Once the protein is cooked, it's rolled up with toppings and rice and a lettuce leaf and dipped in sauce. The growth of EFHG has been closely followed by Larry Carius of Bloomington, who manages a popular Facebook blog called Bloomington Normal Restaurant Scene. Carius said his stories about new EFHG restaurants usually become one of the most read posts of the month. They've obtained enough publicity that when people travel through the Midwest, the Epiphany Farms restaurants have become a stop for many. I think we're very fortunate to have them based in Bloomington Normal, he said. The company's restaurant concepts bring an exclusivity to the Twin Cities that's uncommon for towns this side, said Carius. These are fantastic restaurants, and when they open here, they do well, he said. These unique restaurants are part of the 10-year dream formed by Miska and Stu Hummel, co-owner and executive chef, but their plan for the future continues to evolve. People are realizing what we're doing here is interesting and unique, so we want to keep doing it, said Miska. We want to keep coaching and learning. Future endeavors include a produce subscription box stocked with vegetables, meat, bread, and eggs, all produced through the farm. Miska said the team also plans to hone in on educational opportunities by offering cooking classes and demonstrations. I believe the vast majority of the world's problems could be solved in some way around the dinner table, said Miska. We need to bring a light of importance to our meals. As a restaurateur, it's my job and obligation to narrate that and start the conversation. More information about restaurants, the farms, and the company is available at epiphanyfarms.com. Moving to a little bit of national news now, our next article is titled U.S. Sanctions 19 Russians for Meddling. In its toughest challenge to Russia to date, the Trump administration accused Moscow on Thursday of an elaborate plot to penetrate America's election grid, factories, water supply, and even air travel through cyber hacking. The U.S. also hit targeted Russians with sanctions for alleged election meddling for the first time since President Donald Trump took office. The list of Russians being punished includes all 13 indicted last month by Special Counsel Robert Mueller, a tacit acknowledgement by the administration that at least some of Mueller's Russia-related probe has merit. Trump has repeatedly sought to discredit Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the presidential election, but the sanctions appeared to rely on the special counsel's legal conclusions in deciding who should be named. The sanctions freezes any assets the individuals may have in U.S. jurisdictions and bar Americans from doing business with them. The named Russians, 19 in all, are unlikely to have any assets in the United States that would be covered, making the move largely symbolic. But it could help inoculate the president from persistent claims he's afraid or unwilling to stand up to Russian President Vladimir Putin or to fight back against efforts to undermine America's democracy and domestic affairs. "We're going to be tough on Russia until they decide to change their behavior," said White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders. At the same time, she left open the possibility of better U.S.-Russia cooperation, arguing that if we can work together to combat the world threats on things like North Korea, then we should. U.S. national security officials said FBI, Department of Homeland Security, and intelligence agencies determined Russian intelligence and others were behind a broad range of cyber attacks starting a year ago. Russian hackers infiltrated the networks that run the basic services an American relies on each day: nuclear, water, manufacturing facilities like factories. The officials said the hackers chose their targets methodically, obtained access to computer systems, conducted network reconnaissance, and then attempted to cover their tracks by deleting evidence of the intrusions. The U.S. government has helped the industries expel the Russians from all systems known to have been penetrated, but additional breaches could be discovered, said the officials, who briefed reporters on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive national security information. The officials described Russia's operation as ongoing. The U.S. accusations and accompanying sanctions marked a stepped-up attempt by Trump's administration to show it's adequately confronting Russia over hacking, election meddling, and general efforts to compromise Western democracies and infrastructure. Trump on Thursday also joined the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany in blaming Moscow for the poisoning of an ex-Russian spy who was living in England. The sanctions promised a swift threat of retaliation from Russia's government, which said a response was already being prepared. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov suggested the Trump administration had timed the action to taint this weekend's presidential election in Russia, in which President Vladimir Putin is expected to win an overwhelming victory. "It is tied to U.S. international disorder, tied, of course, to our electoral calendar," Ryabkov was quoted as saying by the Russian state news agency TASS. Also sanctioned were five Russian companies, including the Internet Research Agency, which is accused of orchestrating a mass online disinformation campaign to affect U.S. presidential election results. The U.S. Treasury Department announced the sanctions amid withering criticism in the U.S. accusing Trump and his administration of failing to use its congressionally mandated authority to punish Russia. The sanction targets include officials working for the Russian military intelligence agency GRU. The sanctions are the first use of the new powers that Congress passed last year to punish Moscow for interfering in the election that Trump won over Democrat Hillary Clinton. Yet Russia hawks in Congress deemed it too little, too late. "Even more must be done," said Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. GOP Senator John McCain of Arizona called the action overdue. And Democrats honed in on the fact that the list of Russians hit with sanctions included all of those indicted by Mueller. That shows the administration believes the investigation is legitimate, they argued. Senate Democrat leader Chuck Schumer of New York said the sanctions prove that Mueller's investigation is not a witch hunt, as the president and his allies have claimed. He said it's more clear than ever that the president must not interfere with the special counsel's investigation in any way. And coming back to local news, our next article is titled Jobless Rates Fall Throughout Central Illinois. This is written by Derek Bay. Unemployment is trending down statewide, including in central Illinois, though job growth remains slower than officials would prefer. The state added 41,000 jobs between January 2017 and January 2018, a 0.7% increase. That includes 600 in DeWitt and McLean counties and 100 in Macon County, according to Illinois Department of Employment Security data. Across the state, we had 11 of the 14 metros show improvement, said IDES Public Information Officer Bob Gow. Is it as good of growth as we'd like? No. But it's growth, and it's certainly better than last year or 2 years ago. Still, the bulk of our growth is interstate, 80 north, but we have some gains downstate as opposed to the majority losses we saw the last couple of years. January was the eighth straight month of unemployment. The unemployment rate fell year over year statewide, according to an IDES release. Those figures reflect not only increases in available jobs, but decreases in Illinoisans looking for work. Among the 14 Illinois metro areas, Bloomington, which includes DeWitt and McLean counties, posted the lowest unemployment rates for January, 4.1%. That was a 1.4% drop from January 2017. In that area, you had gains in government jobs, hospitality and leisure, and business and professional services, said Gow. There were also some declines in manufacturing, but that overall number in Bloomington and McLean County is encouraging. State government created 300 new jobs and 200 for local government. Manufacturing dropped by 200 jobs. Macon County unemployment fell 1.7% over the year to 5.3%. Manufacturing added 400 jobs, but trade, transportation, and utilities lost 400. Coles County fell 1.4% to 4.4%. The county gained 111 professional and business services jobs, but lost 165 goods-producing jobs. McLean County unemployment was lower than the metro area at 4%. Only four counties had better rates: Adams, Brown, Monroe, and Washington. Rates in other central Illinois counties varied from 4.4% in Woodford County to 5.2% in Tazewell County. Among cities and towns, Bloomington's unemployment was 4.1% versus 3.7% for Normal and 5.7% for Decatur. And next up, our next story is called Tubman Portrayal Coming to Decatur. Harriet Tubman is about to make another appearance in central Illinois. Catherine Harris, a Springfield resident who's been portraying the famed Underground Railroad conductor for 21 years, will participate in a free event March 24th at the Decatur Public Library. She previously brought her one-woman show to the Normal Theater in September 2014. Not only are her portrayals of Tubman historically informative, but they're also passionate and dramatic representations of the escaped slaves, work freeing hundreds of others, Melody Arnold said. It actually moved quite a few of us to tears, said Arnold, co-chair of the Friends of the Lincoln Trail Homestead State Park and the site of Abraham Lincoln's home when his family moved to Illinois in 1830. The park is about 8 miles west of Decatur. The event will be 2 p.m. March 24th in the library's Madden Auditorium. It's sponsored by the Friends of Lincoln Trail Homestead State Park, the African American Cultural and Genealogical Society of Illinois Museum, and Macon County Historical Society. In an interview with the Pantograph before the 2014 event, the Carbondale native said portraying Tubman is a joy and an honor. She always was a shero to me, Harris said. She was brave, committed, and put her money where her mouth is. Once she freed herself, she wanted to spread it around. She really put her life on the line for what she believed. Harris and Tubman's accomplishments are all the more remarkable given that she was illiterate, female, and black at a time when people in those categories were especially marginalized. Harris, a retired library services director for the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, has portrayed Tubman for schools, churches, and other groups in central Illinois and around the country, and including before members of Congress in Washington, D.C. Tubman was born a slave about 1820 in Dorchester County, Maryland, as Araminta Harriet Ross. She endured the sale of some of her sisters, lashings that left her scarred, and a head injury at the hands of a slave master that left her with seizures and headaches the rest of her life. On September 17, 1849, she escaped to Philadelphia and soon began her life's work, earning the nickname Moses, helping nearly 300 slaves, including her own aging parents, escape by 1860. And our next story is titled Wisconsin Man to Head History Museum, and this is written by Derek Bay. A Wisconsin man with 18 years of museum experience will be the next executive director of the McLean County Museum of History. Adam Lovell, assistant director at Rahr West Art Museum in Manitowoc, will take over the downtown landmark's top job April 2nd, it announced Thursday. Adam checked off all the boxes we were looking at, said Bill Zimmerman, chair of the museum's board. It turned out to be a pretty clear choice. Lovell has worked in museums in California, New Zealand, Iowa, Michigan, and Wisconsin since earning a master's degree in museum studies from John F. Kennedy University in Pleasant Hill, California in 2005. He spent 7 years as curator of collections at the Detroit Historical Society. That's a big outfit with about 50 employees, and he had experience managing six of them, said Zimmerman. Our museum, like most, counts on the efforts of volunteers, and he managed anywhere from 12 to 20 at a time. He also had a lot of experience as a curator, creating exhibits and maintaining artifacts. Zimmerman said Lovell also has experience that can help current staff convert the museum's paper records to digital and maintain the former courthouse. He has a great staff to work with, said Zimmerman. We didn't bring an interim director because we knew that. Lovell said he wasn't looking for a new job, but couldn't pass up an opportunity like the History Museum. He hopes to help the outstanding staff they already have to do great things they already do, and make the museum a lot more of a cultural and historic centerpiece for the community. I'm kind of a professional new guy on the block. I've been known in my career for stepping into a position that has had a lot of problems, he said. This is a little bit of a different environment in that things are going really well, though I wouldn't ever say there isn't anything to improve on. This is a gem of a resource that most places don't have. Lovell said his experience means he has a long list of contacts who may be able to help in the museum try new things. We don't really have trade secrets, he said of museums with a laugh. A big part of moving from museum to museum is you get to see a different perspective on things, and I want to bring that to McLean County. Lovell succeeds Beth Bushman, who left in February to become director of the Children's Discovery Museum in Normal. She spent 22 months in that role after succeeding Greg Coos, who retired. Zimmerman said the board started searching for Wiseman's successor in December, and she helped that process. Seven candidates were interviewed by the board, and four came to the museum for further consideration and to meet with museum staff. Because the museum is a private entity, Zimmerman's salary is not public. Wiseman's salary is now $116,577, but she did not comment on how that compares to her pay at the museum. Moving to some state news, we have a story coming out of Chicago titled New $1 Billion Reservoir Swamped by Storm. Records show that despite a new $1 billion flood control reservoir in Illinois, rain and melting snow swamped the largest section of the project in less than a day last month. Records obtained by the Chicago Tribune reveal that on February 20th, more than 2 inches of rain flushed a torrent of mixed sewage into the deep tunnel system stretching from the Chicago suburb of Wilmette to Westchester, about 25 miles to the southwest. The system filled the Cook Reservoir to capacity, which was built to hold 3.5 billion gallons of wastewater until it can be treated. Metropolitan Water Reclamation District officials were alarmed by the rate of sewage and runoff that rushed into the deep tunnel, but they said the system worked as planned. Frank Pajak, director of the Central Stickney Sanitary District in the southwest suburb, said his constituents were frequently assured that the project would solve their chronic flooding problems. "I've been hearing about deep tunnel forever," said Pajak. "I was at the ribbon cutting for the reservoir, and it looked great. So why am I still getting calls about people standing in ankle-deep sewage in their basement?" But David St. Pierre said the district's executive director said that without the reservoir, the district likely would have been forced to release sewage and runoff into Lake Michigan, a last resort outlet when streets and basements are flooded. "Before McCook came online, we would start seeing sewage overflows almost as soon as it started raining," St. Pierre said. This time, the system held for 20 hours, which makes me fairly optimistic that what we saw last month will be relatively rare. A nearby quarry is expected to be mined by 2029, which would expand the reservoir's capacity to 10 billion gallons. In other news, our next article is titled, FDA Pushes for Nicotine Limits. Agency proposes to cut substance by as much as 80%. Federal health officials took the first step Thursday to slash levels of addictive nicotine in cigarettes, an unprecedented move designed to help smokers quit and preventing future generations from getting hooked. The Food and Drug Administration floated their proposal last summer, but provided new details in a government filing on the potential impact of drastically cutting nicotine from cigarettes by as much as 80%. Currently, there are no limits on nicotine, which occurs naturally in tobacco plants. Under law, the FDA can regulate nicotine, although it cannot remove it completely. The FDA's powers to police the tobacco industry are unique worldwide, and the attempt to restrict nicotine would represent a first in global efforts to reduce smoking-related deaths. Under one scenario, the FDA estimates the U.S. smoking rate could fall as low as 1.4% by 2060, down from the 15% of adults who smoke now. The agency also calculates that about 5 million more people would quit cigarettes within 1 year of implementing limits. The greatest impact, though, would come from preventing young people from ever becoming addicted, they said. Limiting nicotine could help future generations of kids who experiment with cigarettes from making the deadly progression from experimentation to addiction, said Mitch Zeller, the head of the FDA's Tobacco Center. Key to FDA's proposal, nicotine is highly addictive, but not deadly. Instead, it's the burning tobacco and other substances inhaled through smoking that cause cancer, heart disease, and bronchitis. Smoking causes more than 480,000 deaths each year, despite decades of anti-smoking measures that have pushed the smoking rate to new lows. The agency is first seeking comments on a number of issues, including potential unintended consequences, such as creation of a black market for higher nicotine products. And now we have a short story out of nearby Urbana entitled U of I to Boost Student Health Insurance Costs. University of Illinois trustees have voted to increase student health insurance premiums for the 2018-2019 academic year. The Thursday approval means premiums will go up about 15% for Urbana-Champaign campus students based on more claims over the last year. Undergraduate students on that campus will now pay $455 per semester, and graduate students will pay $582. Springfield campus students will see a 3% increase and pay $530 a semester. Rates won't change for Chicago campus students. They'll continue to pay $570 a semester. The health insurance provided by United Healthcare is optional. School officials tell the Champaign News Gazette that the Urbana-Champaign campus saw a 26% increase in student claims for outpatient visits, prescription drugs, maternity care, and mental health services. They say the insurer paid $1.06 for every $1 collected in premiums. And now let's get some health news with the Ask the Doctors section of the newspaper. This is written by Elizabeth Coe and Eve Glazer. Today's segment is titled, Good Hygiene Limits Spread of Germs at Public Swimming Pool. And so the question they're posed with cold weather, Our kids, who love swimming, switched from the lake to the pool at our local Y. Just how dangerous is it to swim in a public pool? I keep hearing there's a bug that chlorine doesn't kill. And the answer. Anytime you share a common space, whether with one other person or a crowd, you run the risk of being exposed to whatever germs, viruses, parasites, bacteria, molds, and other environmental hitchhikers they may have brought along. Unsurprisingly, this applies to the public swimming pool, where diarrhea is the most common recreational water illness. And while chlorine significantly reduces the potential health risks posed by public swimming pools, it's not a guarantee. When used in the proper amounts needed to maintain a consistent pH, chlorine eliminates all manner of nasty bugs. Chlorinated pool water kills E. coli in less than a minute. Norovirus and hepatitis A perish after 15 minutes. Giardia lasts for only about 45 minutes in properly chlorinated water. However, Cryptosporidium, a microscopic parasite that causes diarrheal disease that can last 2 to 3 weeks, is different. Due to a protective coating during part of its life cycle, we'll get into that in a minute, Cryptosporidium, commonly known as crypto, can survive for up to 10 days in the pool, even one that's properly maintained. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in recent years, Cryptosporidium has become the leading cause of swimming pool-related outbreaks of diarrheal illnesses in the United States. Anytime an infected person passes any amount of feces into the water, they're also releasing the parasite. At this point in its life cycle, crypto is encased in a hard, thick-walled shell, a form known as oocysts. When a swimmer somehow swallows or inhales water that contains an oocyst, the parasite enters the body. It then moves through the digestive system into the cells lining the gut, where it begins to multiply rapidly. Up to 100 million oocysts can be released in a single bowel movement. It's not just swimming pools that are at risk when used by people infected with crypto. Water parks, hot tubs, and recreational fountains can become contaminated as well. So can lakes and the ocean. Although there, with a vastly larger volume of water, the odds of contact are somewhat reduced. Ironically, the very chemicals used to keep swimming pool water clean can themselves become health hazards. The scent of chlorine, particularly in indoor pools where adequate ventilation can be difficult, is a sign that chloramines, a compound present in chlorinated water, has turned to gas. Chloramines can cause nasal irritation, coughing, or wheezing, and can even trigger asthma attacks. Your best defense is insisting on good pool etiquette. 1. Choose a pool that insists patrons take a pre-swim shower. Make sure that anyone with diarrhea never goes into the pool. If you have young children, take them on frequent bathroom breaks. Remember, diapers don't belong in the swimming pool. And lastly, anytime you see feces in the water or when the smell of chlorine becomes strong, tell pool management. With only a few minutes left in this first segment, we'll wrap up with today's Flick Fact. So, the question, perhaps the ultimate of compliments to a college or university, is when a child attends the same college as her parents. For example, a 1997 graduate of Illinois Wesleyan in theater arts is Sarah Jenkins. Can you name her parents? Well, if you don't know, I'll tell you the answer. Her mom is the former Sharon Frederick, and her dad is Richard Jenkins. They're both graduates of the IWU class of 1969. Sarah is today a 39-year-old mother and actress. Her dad also graduated in theater arts at IWU, and just this year was up for an Academy Award for his Best Supporting Actor role in the movie The Shape of Water. That's going to wrap up the first half of the Pantograph News, but please stick around. We'll have more after a little break. My name is Matt Woodbury. Thank you for listening. This has been the Pantograph News from the edition dated Friday, March 16th. We'll be back soon.